Howdy, it's me again. So I teach a course on the history and philosophy of science. And in this class, at the beginning of every semester, I notice something interesting. It's always been this way as long as I've taught the class. Most of the students start the semester off thinking, well, of course religion and science conflict. That's just the way it is. That's the way it always has been. And this is a way of thinking about the world that is consistent with the way that most Americans think. There was a study done by Pew, and 59% of Americans think that religion and science conflicts. But interestingly, most Americans think their own religious views don't conflict with science. It's just somebody else's religious views out there. So that's kind of weird if you think about it. And so I started getting interested into researching this more and kind of thinking about this more because of the way that my students think about this, but also the way that their thinking evolves over the course of the semester. So as I had mentioned, cosmos is one of those things that got me interested early on about the history and philosophy of science. And to be honest, I might have become a scientist if my math weren't so crap. And since my math is really bad, I wound up doing the history of science, so that way I can stay away from the math part. But when you watch something like Cosmos, or when you read about the relationship between religion and science, then one of those areas that you're going to kind of bump into is thinking about the Middle Ages. And the Middle Ages actually became my specialty. That's what I've written most about. That's where most of my interest has been. And as one writer termed it, a guy in the 19th century, the late 19th century, Andrew W. Draper, the Middle Ages was the time when the dead hand of faith crushed science. And so that's pretty clear about how he feels about this. But since his book is called The History of the Warfare Between Theology and Science, well, I kind of think we know where his ideas are coming from to begin with. But is that really what was going on? So during the Middle Ages, there were actually a lot of interesting intellectual things happening that most people just don't even know about today. So I teach at a university. Universities came out of the Middle Ages. They were a creation of the Middle Ages, and they were basically developed by the Catholic Church as a place to train priests. And so if you think about that, that right there tells you, well, okay, so maybe there's something a little bit more going on with religion and science in the Middle Ages than we might think. And it's also interesting that at these universities, if you were a priest in training, then what you would really study for your first few years while you were there in order to get your bachelor's degree was Aristotle. And Aristotle was all about understanding the natural world. And so a priest in training would be expected to get the equivalent of a combination degree in physics, a degree in biology, and a cosmology. There'd be so many different things that you would have to study. And why is that? Because as far as the medieval church was concerned, you want to understand God, but how do you understand God? You can't bring him in. You can't sit him down and say, hey, God, I got some questions for you. That just doesn't work very well. So instead, you have to study what God has created. And you know what God created if you're a Christian? Well, you think God created everything. So you need to understand the natural world so that you can understand God better. And that's really what the story was kind of getting at that I told the kids about Hugh. Hugh of St. Victor wanted to understand God better by understanding God's creation, the world. So in the Middle Ages, you had people who were very interested in understanding that natural world. People like, I was just talking to Gus earlier, Albertus Magnus, Albert the Great. Albert the Great was a 13th century theologian. He had a doctorate in theology from the University of Paris. And for Catholics today, he's considered the saint of scientists. He was canonized back in the 1960s. And Albert really wanted to understand God, but when he wanted to understand God, he spent most of his time writing about things like geology and mineralogy and the natural world and astronomy. And so his approach to understanding God was very different than what those fundamentalists that Neil deGrasse Tyson was pointing to would have taken. Now, admittedly, during the Middle Ages, there wasn't as much scientific development as we have experienced in the modern world. And there are reasons for that. There were things working against them. So on the one hand, there was just a lot of stuff going wrong, a lot of bad things that happened during the Middle Ages. And when you spend most of your time worrying about having enough to eat, then you can't worry as much about, you know, what we would think of as science. But there were also some scientific traditions, or there were some cultural traditions that the people of the Middle Ages had carried over from the ancient Greeks that played against them. This is kind of interesting because, again, if you watch Cosmos, the ancient Greeks are the good guys. They're the ones who were really, you know, kind of doing stuff. And then along came those nasty Christians and crushed what they were doing. But in reality, the ancient Greeks, they wanted to understand the natural world, but they thought about understanding the natural world as basically a thinking exercise. And there's a lot in science that requires thinking and thought exercises, but you also need to actually perform experiments. You have to do stuff with your hands. But for the ancient Greeks and people of the Middle Ages, doing stuff with your hands, that's very low class. That's what slaves did for the Greeks. And so during the Middle Ages, people didn't experiment because they were basically using what the ancient Greeks had given them. And they thought, well, people who are intellectuals, we're not going to go out there and mess around with our hands and actually do stuff. And so that idea of experimentation wasn't something they used. Instead, it was all thought exercises. There were occasional attempts at things that are sort of experiment light. So, for example, Albertus Magnus, the guy that I just mentioned, he read Aristotle had mentioned that birds eat stones, and he thought, well, that's weird, and he wanted to find out if that was true. So how do you find out if that's true? Well, you get a bunch of chickens together, and you try to feed them rocks. And he tried various things. He put honey on the rocks and all this kind of things. And really, all they got out of this experiment was a bunch of confused chickens. But they didn't eat the rocks, and so he decided Aristotle was wrong here. So that's about as close as you're going to get for the Middle Ages with experimentation. So in order to get to the point where people are performing experimentation, where they can actually do what we think of as science, then you have to get past a cultural tradition that says doing stuff with your hands is just low class and it's not great. And you also have to get past a cultural tradition where the most prestigious thing that you can do is get a doctorate in theology and focus all of your energies on studying God. Now, that doesn't mean that religion and science clash. It just means that science in the Middle Ages wasn't very prestigious. It wasn't something that people thought of as very high class. So today, if somebody were to come home, if a young lady or fellow were to come home and say, hey, I've met somebody who's great, I want to get married, and mom and dad says, okay, what does this person do? And they said, well, he's, you know, working on his doctorate in theology. Then they would say, you're going to starve to death. Don't marry him. But in the Middle Ages, a doctorate in theology was absolutely the most prestigious thing you could do. And studying science was something that people did more like a hobby. So, changing cultural traditions, really important. And that's where we get into the Renaissance and what some people still call the scientific revolution. During the Renaissance, working with your hands becomes cool again. Because working with your hands means that you create art. You do paintings, you do sculptures. And so high-class people were giving lots of money to people who could create that kind of stuff. And so it became much more popular and common for people to do those sort of manual exercises, to get out and do stuff with your hands again. And so we have people come along like a fellow by the name of Galileo. Now, Galileo really had a lot of reasons that he wanted to get as much prestige as he could. So he wanted people to think of him as cool and awesome. He actually didn't have a university degree at all. And yet he wound up teaching math at universities and teaching what today we would think about as physics and things like this. And so since he didn't have the right kind of degrees and the right kind of background, then he needed prestige. And he had trained as an artist. And so he begins thinking about, how can I kind of blow people's minds? How can I come up with something new that nobody else has done before and a new kind of thing that people will really be impressed by? And he also needed to do this because he had a lot of sisters. And he was responsible for, at the time, it was thought that as the oldest brother, he was responsible for taking care of them, coming up with money for their dowry so they could get married and things. He was always strapped for cash, is basically what it came down to. And so how does he get people to give him money, and how does he get people to think that he is worthy of being seen as an intellectual? So he's trying to come up with new ideas and new ways of doing things, and that includes he hears about this new invention called the telescope.
And when he hears about the telescope, he decides, I'm going to make one of those, and I'm going to make one better than anybody has done before. And so he makes it, he points it at the sky, and because he's trained as an artist, when he looks at the moon, he sees things nobody had seen before. And other people had looked at the same thing, but they just didn't see what he saw because they didn't have his training in art. But he also starts performing experiments, for the first time, real experiments, the way that we think about experiments now. And so he started rolling balls to try to determine how fast that things fall and things like this. Now, the reason why I bring Galileo up is because that if you talk about that conflict idea, that idea that science and religion are in conflict, then Galileo always immediately comes up. Because Galileo wanted, like I said, to do something brand new that nobody had done before, and he was really interested in this new idea that the Earth actually goes around the sun rather than vice versa. And that was a new idea at the time. And so Galileo goes to his buddy, the Pope. And he had known the Pope before the Pope became the Pope. And he said, hey, I want to write this book, and I want to write this book about the way that the Earth goes around the sun. And the Pope says, go for it, dude. That sounds awesome. So there wasn't this big conflict there. However, the Pope did tell him, said, you know, you want to focus your book on this idea about the tides. Galileo wanted to call it On the Tides. Because Galileo had this idea that he could prove that the Earth moves because of the tides. So if you ever have something like, I have my glass of water here and I'm trying not to spray it everywhere. But if you move it around like this, you see the water kind of moving around in the glass. And Galileo had the idea that the reason why that the tides happen is because the Earth is moving around the sun, and as the Earth moves, that makes the tides go back and forth. Now, if you're sitting there thinking, well, that's stupid, so did people in the 17th century when Galileo came up with this idea. They said, dude, we know how the tides work, and it has to do with the moon. It's not because of the motions of the Earth. And they didn't know exactly, so they didn't know about gravity, but they knew that his idea was, you know, crap. And then on top of that, Galileo was just plain wrong about some stuff. Like, he had this idea that comets are something that just happens in the atmosphere. And people knew that was wrong. People knew what comets were, in essence. They knew there were something that flew through space. And so the Pope told Galileo, go ahead and write your book, man. But you just can't say that you have 100% proven that the Earth goes around the sun. And Galileo says, okay, no problem. So he writes this book, and he writes it as a dialogue. And so there's basically a guy arguing that, yes, the Earth goes around the sun. There's a guy arguing that it doesn't. And then there's sort of the neutral observer in the middle. But the guy who argues that the Earth doesn't go around the sun, that the sun goes around the Earth, Galileo calls him Simplicissimus, which basically means the stupidest person alive. And then on top of that, he adds in stuff that that guy says that are direct quotes of things that the Pope had said back when the Pope used to be a university professor. So once this book comes out, people who don't like Galileo, and there were a lot of people who didn't like Galileo, because Galileo was one of those people who he was probably smarter than everybody who he met, but he never let you forget that. And he was constantly rubbing it in. And if he disagreed with you, it wasn't like, well, I think that you might be mistaken. It was, well, you're wrong and you're stupid. And here's why you're stupid. And so people didn't like Galileo. A lot of people didn't. So when this book came out, people went running to the Pope and said, look right here, he's making fun of you. And the Pope felt like he'd been stabbed in the back because he had been buddies with Galileo. And here's his friend writing this book that makes him look like an idiot. And so the Pope got angry, overreacted, and he demanded that Galileo come in and have a little meeting with the Inquisition. Galileo didn't want to. He said, I'm old, I'm not in good health. And he said, well, that's fine. We'll go ahead and convict you as a heretic in absentia and have you burned at the stake. And he said, whoa, hang on, I can come in. So the point about this is, yes, Galileo was convicted by the church, and he was convicted by the church for saying some things that the church said that he shouldn't, that today we would think he was perfectly within his right to do so. But really what got Galileo in trouble was that he had a horrible personality, and he was just a really not a great person to be around in a lot of ways. So the point about this is, this whole idea that religion and science are necessarily in conflict, it's not that there's never been any conflicts, but it's a lot more complicated than just saying that it's religion and science And instead, there's all sorts of other factors that come in. So, for example, let's fast forward just a little bit, and let's talk about that dude that you've heard of called Charles Darwin. So Charles Darwin comes out, and he had done a lot of work on evolution by natural selection. And Charles Darwin had this idea that basically all complex life that we see around us had started off with less complex forms, had developed over time. At first, he didn't say anything about humans. In his first book on the origin of the species, he didn't say about anything about humans. But then later on, he wrote another book and he applied this to humans. Now, there are a lot of people today who see this as sort of one of those flashpoints for the conflict between religion and science. But at the time that Darwin came out with this book, it was a lot more complicated than that. So Darwin comes out with this book, and the Royal Society in England decided that maybe Darwin would be a good candidate for a receipt of what was called the Copley Medal. And today, the Copley Medal would have the prestige of the Nobel Prize. So it was the most prestigious thing that you could get for doing work in science. But there were people who thought that what Darwin was doing didn't really work well as science. They thought that his methodology, they thought that his methods weren't what should be done, what a scientist should be doing. So that's one thing. And there were people who disagreed with him, obviously. But then there were also people who said, you know, what he's doing might upset the social order and that he is undercutting religion. So, for example, there was a bishop by the name of Samuel Wilberforce. And Samuel Wilberforce was a very good public speaker, and he gave sermons. And he said that if we have this idea that, you know, less complex develops into more complex and just everything is the same because it all came out of the same thing, then why would we have aristocrats? Why would we have kings and queens? Why would we have nobles? Because after all, if everybody came from the same place, that just destroys the entire social structure. So Samuel Wilberforce, he was upset about what Darwin had written, but he was partially upset about it because he kind of liked rich people just being in charge of everything. And he liked the poor people saying, yeah, you guys should be in charge. We shouldn't be questioning that. And so it was more complex than just his religious beliefs. And you can see that because you have other people, like a fellow by the name of John Henry Newman. You may have heard of him as Cardinal Newman. At the time, Newman was an Anglican priest, so he was not yet Catholic. And when Darwin's book came out, Newman said, yeah, this makes perfect sense to me. And he wrote about it, he supported it, and he even said there was this old Catholic guy, Augustine, way back in the 4th century and 5th century, who said something that sounded very similar. And so people like Newman were religious leaders, and they fully supported Darwin's thought. And from the beginning, that was the way that the Catholic Church saw it. There was debate within the Catholic Church, but by the end of the 19th century, the Catholic Church was saying, yeah, sure, that sounds right. And so by the 1960s, the Catholic Church came out firmly on the side of Darwinian evolution. So the point about this is there were people on sort of both sides of the debate, but it wasn't as simple as breaking it down as some people had a problem with Darwin because of religious belief. And there was nothing necessarily inherent in Darwin's thought that would cause religious people to just reject it out of hand. And today, the majority of religious people in the world, so the Catholic Church, the Episcopalian Church, for example, have come right out and said, yes, this is consistent with our beliefs. So, you know, there's that. So another flashpoint, another one of those areas, though, where you have conflict between religion and science, as it's seen, is the Big Bang Theory. So I grew up in a Baptist tradition. And I remember that when I was a kid, I came home one day and I had been reading about the Big Bang Theory. And I was really into it because I loved science and I loved reading about this kind of stuff. But I, at the time, was going to a private school that was a religious school. And it was a brand of religion, it was a form of religion in which things like Darwinian evolution and the Big Bang Theory were rejected. And so when I had raised the issue with my teacher was like, that's just a load of crap. And I came home and I talked to my mom, and to my mom's credit, she only has a 5th grade education. And she basically said, well, explain to me what this is. And I explained it to her as best I could. And she said, well, I don't really know, but what I do know is that the scientists say that that's the way it happened. And if the scientists say that that's the way that they happened, they understand it a lot better, then it makes sense to believe them rather than your teacher. And I went, okay. So go, mom, with your 5th grade education. But the point about this is the Big Bang Theory is another one of those ideas where people like Baptists, the tradition I came out of when I was young, tend to just immediately kind of get their hackles up and say, well, that's not true. That's not the that can't be true because God created the universe in, you know, 6 days. However, when we think about the history of where the theory came from, it immediately becomes a little bit more complex. So there was a fellow by the name of George Lemaître. And George Lemaître was a really interesting guy to look at. He was Belgian. He studied mathematics. He got a PhD in Belgium. And then he decided that wasn't enough. And so he went over to Oxford in England and got another PhD. Because apparently you can't have enough. And so he was really, really interested in cosmology and mathematics. He had also, by the way, served in World War I and been awarded a Medal of Valor for his service in World War I. So again, really interesting guy. Oh, and I forgot to mention one of the more interesting things about him. He was a Jesuit priest. So Lemaître was interested in how that the universe had developed and how it had come to be the way that we see it today. And basically, he sat down and he started working out mathematical modeling, and he started looking at the work that people before him had done. And he came up with this idea that he called the cosmic egg theory. And today, we would call it the Big Bang. And it's the idea that at one point, basically, what he did was he looked at the universe around him. He looked at the way that the universe is expanding, as had been shown by the astronomer Hubble. And he basically wound everything backwards using math and said, if you wind it backwards, then at one point everything must have been at a singularity, a single point, and that would have created this condition in which there would have been a lot of energy involved and an explosion would have been inevitable. Now, when Lemaître first came up with this idea, there was an astronomer by the name of Fred Hoyle who just ridiculed it. And he said, that's just a load of horse pucky. He said, there's no way. And he said, I'm an atheist, you're a priest, and what you're doing is religion. That's not science. And so Fred Hoyle is the one who came up with the term, the Big Bang Theory, to make fun of it. And Fred Hoyle died in the 70s and never believed the Big Bang Theory. He always said that it was not true. Albert Einstein initially said, it's a religious idea, man. It's not a scientific idea. Something from nothing. But then Lemaître went to a conference at Berkeley, and this was a very high-level conference where only the most kind of highest-level mathematicians and thinkers were, and Einstein was there. And Lemaître basically showed Einstein his math and said, here's why that I think what I do, here's the evidence. And at the end of his presentation, Einstein stood up in the audience and said, this is the most elegant explanation for the origins of the universe that I have ever heard, and I fully support it. And so he changed his mind in the course of an hour-long, really math-heavy presentation. So the point about this is, it's kind of interesting that so many people who are more fundamentalist in their religious approaches today see things like the Big Bang Theory as sort of one of those spark points that they just absolutely can't bend on this. When the idea started off as presented by a Jesuit priest who had a couple of PhDs in math and mathematical astronomy, and the people who opposed him were people who were atheists and thought it just sounded too much like a religious idea. And so this whole idea of a conflict between religion and science just isn't as simple as that. And just as an aside to kind of throw out there when you think about, well, where did it come from? In the 19th century, remember that guy I mentioned, Andrew W. Dixon, and he wrote this book about the warfare of theology and science? Andrew W. Dixon was, interestingly, not even a historian. He was a chemist who got interested in writing about science or about history. And so he actually wrote a comprehensive history of the Civil War, but he also wrote this really fat history about, you know, religion and science. But Dixon was living at a time in the 19th century in which there were things happening that he wasn't super happy with. On the one hand, he wasn't super happy with the development of fundamentalism. In the late 19th century, there were a series of books that came out that were called The Fundamentals, and that's where our term fundamentalism comes from. In the late 19th century, by the way, it wasn't as simple as saying fundamentalists opposed Darwin's theory. In the late 19th century, there were some fundamentalists who opposed it, and others said, yeah, sure, this sounds fine. And so they hadn't gotten around to there yet. But they were starting to get really concerned about changes in the world. And so they were worried about development of modernity. And so they worried about things like, for example, this is when, once we get into the early 1900s, cars were becoming more common. And you know what you can do with cars? Young men and women can go dating. And that's an invention of the early 20th century. And you know what else? When young men and women are in cars together, you don't know what else they're doing. And so they were really worried about what those kids might be doing in cars. And so they developed this just sort of general distaste for and fear of the modern world in general. And this was around the same time period when Darwin's theory was starting to make a huge comeback. Because a lot of biologists had noticed that Darwin didn't really understand heredity, and so they had started to get away from it. But then in the 1920s and 30s, biologists rediscovered a work by a fellow by the name of Gregor Mendel. And Mendel is the one who did work with pea plants and kind of figured out the way that heredity works. And that got blended together with Darwin's theory to make for a much more robust theory that explained the world. So back to Andrew W. Dixon. He was working at this time when he was worried about kind of the rising fundamentalism of people who were opposing science, and he didn't like that. But he also was really upset about this group of people who were coming to America just in droves, who didn't speak our language, they don't share our culture, they were just coming over here and stealing our jobs. Does that sound familiar, by the way? Anybody heard anything like that? The difference is in the 19th century, those people were Irish. And they were all flocking over because there were a lot of bad economic conditions in Ireland beginning in the middle of the century when there had been this huge famine. They had driven a lot of people out of the country. And most of the Irish people who were coming over were the poorer Irish. And since they were poor Irish, that means that most of them were Catholic. And so Dixon really, really hated Catholicism. And if you read this book, this Warfare of Theology and Science, it's really an anti-Catholic rant is what it is. He does say that there are some religious good guys, and this is kind of interesting from a modern point. The Muslims, for example, he says the Muslims, they really got this science and religious thing right. And so it's kind of interesting from a modern standpoint how much views have changed. So anyway, the point that I'm making about all of this is this conflict thesis, this idea that there's inherent conflict between religion and science, is something that really, as much as anything else, grew out of anti-Catholic bias of the 19th and 20th century. Some of you may even remember that when Kennedy ran for president, a lot of people didn't support him because he was Catholic, and they said, oh, the Pope will just take over the country if that happens. And so this anti-Catholic feeling was rampant. And it's just a lot more complex than saying that it's anything about religion and science. And instead, you have an awful lot of people throughout history who are very religious, wanted to understand the world for religious reasons, and that was driving them to do the kinds of research and work that they were doing. And so I would argue, as a historian, that there have been just as many, if not more, instances in which religious belief has driven an effort to understand the world than when you have religious belief that creates conflict. Galileo himself was a deeply committed religious man. And he was working from the theories of a guy by the name of Johannes Kepler, who really only wanted to understand the world, and he did a lot of astronomical work because he was a committed Lutheran and wanted to understand the world because he wanted to understand God better. So religion and science has been complementary. It's worked together far more often than it's conflicted. And that's just a historical fact. So there you go.